From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, federal money is still trapped in a deadlock over Michigan's budget.
It doesn't even appear that there's any actual discussions going on, but obviously there's a lot at stake here.
Also, a new podcast aimed at clearing the air in Michigan politics.
This was not going to be your typical shout fest, which both of us are entirely capable of doing. We've done it for years. But it was going to be a thoughtful discussion.
And there's an unconventional ring to wedding bells this year. We'll talk to two folks planning nuptials in an ever-changing pandemic.
We decided, hey, 100 folks, by September, this thing will be cool. There'll probably be some sort of vaccine or herd immunity. And as we know, September was the prelude to the worst of the outbreak.
All that coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the show, we'll check in with a couple Michiganders who are altering wedding plans amid the continued uncertainty presented by COVID.
So we were essentially, from a planning perspective, in the home stretch of things before we got an email from our venue saying that they were going to have to make major changes and our ceremony was going to be very, very different.
That's later in the program, but first, we have a couple of updates from Lansing we wanted to tackle today. You may have heard in our newscasts about the ongoing standoff between Governor Whitmer and the legislature over budget appropriations, and in particular, federal COVID relief funds. To help us unpack this, Rick Pluta, Capital Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, joins us now. Hey, Rick.
Hello.
So there's this large pot of money from the federal government's COVID relief package that came to Michigan that has been banked in Michigan, but has yet to be allocated in Michigan. Can you bring us up to speed on what the money was intended for and what's happening to it?
Well, yeah, and there is this question over whether or not it's just sitting in the bank waiting for Michigan to use, or whether or not, if Michigan doesn't use it and use it soon, that it could be allocated somewhere else. And, I mean, this is part of the continuing drama over who is going to control Michigan's COVID-19 response, especially when it comes to things like schools and business shutdowns. And so the Republicans have sent a budget bill to Governor Whitmer's desk with some limits on it, that closing schools would be more of a local decision than a state decision, for example. And now it's just a question of whether she's going to sign or veto it, and that would serve as a signal as to how this bargaining might continue going forward. And Republicans really seem to think that they're in the driver's seat on this. They're holding confirmation of the governor's MDHHS, the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services director, still out there. And so there's just a lot of things that are hanging fire while this dispute over who controls what is that they're trying to settle.
Rick, what explanations have Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey and House Speaker Jason Wentworth given for why they're holding on to the money?
That this is something that should be a shared decision between the governor and the legislature, that Michigan will not lose the money, and that the governor needs to bargain with the legislature on how this money gets appropriated, and they want to do it over time so they maintain a level of control for the legislative branch in this process. That's their explanation.
Does it appear that there's any resolution for this on the horizon?
Not as of right now. It doesn't even appear that there's any actual discussions going on. So, no, but obviously there's a lot at stake here. And at some point, they're going to have to come to some kind of resolution on this.
Hey, Rick, we've been hearing that the governor is going to announce Monday that she's going to support the campaign to expand Michigan's Elliott Larson protections. Can you explain what's going on, both in terms of a ballot campaign and the legislature?
Oh, sure. Well, the Elliott-Larsen Act has been around since the 1970s, and it protects against things like race and gender discrimination. And the newest wrinkle in that is the push to add LGBTQ protections to the law. And I should say that this issue has been hanging around since, I would say since 1983. That's when Republican State Representative Jim Dressel became the first Republican lawmaker to co-sponsor a bill to do that. He lost a challenge in his Republican primary. That happened again in 2014 to State Representative Frank Foster, who said that this was the direction that society was taken. Should point out that Foster lost his primary to future House Speaker Lee Chatfield, who just lost his new job as the leader of the Kalamazoo area's Economic Development Group, largely because of his history on LGBT rights. So now fast forward to today, that there is legislation, there's a ballot campaign out there that's collected signatures to either put the question to the legislature or on the ballot. Governor Whitmer endorsing this effort isn't news. That she's been pro-LGBTQ rights since she was in the legislature, but this is basically the newest push to make this happen. We've got two Republican lawmakers right now, Tommy Brand in the House, Wayne Schmidt in the Senate, who are willing to co-sponsor a bill, who have co-sponsored a bill that would add these protections. The petition campaign is out there. The prospects of a ballot campaign are out there. And so what the proponents of this movement are hoping is that the weight of all of these things will get the legislature to adopt an expansion of Elliott-Larsen, as opposed to, you know, waiting for this to go on the ballot. As of right now, Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky is still on the record against this. And so it's very much, it remains to be seen.
Have you heard whether the campaign that was working on the ballot measure, do you know if they're hoping to get it on the ballot soon, maybe this year?
It would go on the ballot next year, but they've turned in their signatures that they say that they have enough, and that since public opinion seems to be largely in favor of this, that the legislature should just get it out of the way, adopt either one of these bills or adopt the petition language if and when it's put before the legislature, rather than making it go on the ballot in 2022.
What are you hearing about the bill's chances? Like you say, this is a pretty accepted concept within Michigan's public opinion, but the legislature is under Republican control.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's kind of it, that that the backers of this proposal are hoping that with a couple of Republicans on board, that will make it safer for other Republicans to come on board. And they say, based on their straw polls of legislative support, that if it were put to a vote between Democrats in the House and the Senate and some Republicans who might come on board, that it would pass. And if that is in fact true, and we can't say for sure that it is, but if that is in fact true, then it would simply be a matter of getting it on the calendar in the House and in the Senate to make it happen and then open it up for adoption.
Yeah. Do you think Gretchen Whitmer's imprint will make any difference on this bill's chances? Or in terms of a ballot campaign?
Well, again, the fact that she supports this expansion is nothing new. But anytime a governor says that they're willing to throw their shoulder behind an effort, it makes a difference. You know, if for nothing else, then it inspires people in the cause, and in this case, Democrats in the legislature, to push that much harder for it, because they know that if they can get this across the line and onto her desk, that then it's fait accompli.
Rick Pluta covers politics for Michigan's public radio stations. Rick, thank you so much.
Always glad to talk to you, Avery.
Just a day ago, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan expressed some skepticism about using the Johnson & Johnson vaccine in Detroit, a vaccine that wasn't as effective in clinical trials against COVID as Moderna and Pfizer's vaccines, but is potentially more effective against newer variants of the virus. Health officials all across the state have expressed concern about Duggan's stance, saying any vaccination in circulation right now will help fight the spread of COVID. So after a reported phone call from the White House, Mike Duggan issued this statement today, quoting here, "As vaccine eligibility expands, Detroit will open a second site offering Johnson & Johnson vaccines. I have full confidence that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is both safe and effective. We're making plans now for Johnson & Johnson to be a key part of our expansion of vaccine centers and are looking forward to receiving Johnson & Johnson vaccines in the next allocation." Of all the things COVID-19 has upended, the most personal one might be our relationships with each other. We want to know, how have your relations with your friends, with your family, with total strangers changed during the pandemic? Maybe you're feeling sick of your pod right now, or finding joy in having more time with your family. Maybe you're trying to navigate socially distanced dating. Whatever your experience, we'd love to hear about it. Send us your stories of pod life by leaving us a voicemail at 734-764-7840. One more time, that's 734-764-7840. Or email us at stateside@michiganradio.org. And then tune in next week for a deep dive on pandemic relationships and advice on how to keep each other close in tough times. Again, the email address is stateside@michiganradio.org. Is there a way to calm down the ever-increasing virulent political discourse in Michigan and across the country? Two former leaders in Michigan's Democratic and Republican parties are trying to do just that with a new podcast.
What Jeff and I hope to do in our very modest way is show that things can be different, that the discourse doesn't have to be yelling and screaming and people retreating to partisan corners.
We'll talk to them in just a minute. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In our era of deeply divided politics, it's hard to imagine Republican and Democratic Party insiders teaming up for any kind of spirited conversation in any format or forum. But that's just what former Democratic State Party Chair Mark Brewer and former Republican Party Director Jeff Timmer are doing. They have a new podcast and web show called A Republic If You Can Keep It. Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer join us now. Guys, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I just want to begin by sort of leveling the playing field and asking each of you to recount an embarrassing or at least a telling story about your co-host. Mark, would you like to go first?
Oh, boy. I have such great respect for Jeff. He has been the consummate political professional, does a great job for his party for so many years. And I think that, you know, there's been a mutual feeling of respect, which grew into what we're now doing. Embarrassing. Well, I hate to say this, Jeff, but I think what was probably embarrassing for you was during the gerrymandering case when we discovered you kept all those emails from back in 2011 and 12, and those became the centerpiece of our lawsuit over the skillful gerrymandering that you did.
I would have, if I had gone first, I would have chosen the same instances, the most embarrassing. It goes to show you, one, never write anything down. And number two, what you think has been deleted often is not deleted. And so, yeah, that was quite the embarrassing moment. And it wasn't embarrassing because of anything necessarily that I had done or said. Most of the, controversial or notorious exchanges were missives that were lobbed at me, people saying things to me. But nonetheless, I was the kind of the fulcrum of the lawsuit. And those exchanges, became the crux of many stories and the butt of many jokes.
I would say that one thing that I found very good during the course of that litigation, Jeff, and this shows the professionalism of Jeff. Early on, I spent several days in Lansing serving subpoenas on a wide variety of folks. I was able to call Jeff up, and he was professional enough to say, sure, I'll take the subpoena. He didn't spend days and weeks dodging the subpoena. He didn't play games. He took the subpoena, and we went from there.
You two are tremendous good sports to answer the question, but I hope that shows people something about, for lack of a better term, the working relationship that you two have had over the years. How in the world, though, did you start talking about doing a podcast and a show?
Well, it was really through a mutual friend who approached us both with the idea. And once the concept was explained to me, once I knew it was Jeff, and the concept was explained to me that this was not going to be your typical shout fest, which both of us are entirely capable of doing. We've done it for years. But it was going to be a thoughtful discussion. There can be differences of opinion, of course. That really attracted me, that it would be different from the typical political discourse nowadays.
I agree. And during the last year or two, I've been very vocal in my opposition to Donald Trump and to many in the Republican Party, now I call my former party, due to their fealty and enabling of Trump. And during that time, there had been a couple of instances where I'd reached out to Mark to work on something that was bigger than partisan wins or partisan battles, and that was the effort to save our democracy, protect the integrity of our election. And, from that, even though, 2 years ago, right about now, I was sitting in a federal courthouse on the witness stand, with Mark as the opposing attorney in that aforementioned gerrymandering case, I was willing to set aside any differences that we had to work for something bigger, and Mark was willing to do the same. And we've had a great amount of respect, and the respect only grew during this last year.
Well, Jeff, I guess, Mark, if you have thoughts on this too, I'd love to hear what you have to say. But Jeff, you of all people, I think, have had a chance to witness the limits of debate over the past 4 years, given that what happened during the Trump years in the GOP was sort of an outing of the fact that people are just living in two different worlds. Why did you think that there might be something to add to the conversation by the both of you coming together like this?
Well, I think one thing that seems to be so sorely lacking in our politics, and really the way politics and culture are intertwined, it's so infected the culture and relationships between people, is the idea that you can be opponents, but you're not enemies. You can have disagreements, different opinions, different solutions to common problems. But that doesn't mean if you're not 100% with my idea of what the solution should be, if you're against me 5% of the time, there's this notion now that suddenly you're my enemy. And that exists within both political parties to an extent. There's certainly a dogmatic orthodoxy that's being enforced on the Republican side, that if you're not 100% in agreement of whatever it is Donald Trump wants or says, that you're somehow a heretic and you're going to be stoned in the public square. And that's where I found myself. And that's what I think is so toxic and wrong about politics today.
Mark Brewer, how would you describe the tone that you're going for with the podcast, with what Jeff said in mind?
Well, I agree with Jeff. I mean, we're both believers in democracy. I think there have to be two strong political parties in this country, both devoted to democracy, who accept election results. And so that's really my purpose. I would like to see the Republican Party rehabilitated into a party that believes in democracy again. But I think what Jeff and I hope to do in our very modest way is show that things can be different, that the discourse doesn't have to be yelling and screaming and people retreating to partisan corners, that we can have thoughtful discussions. And so, again, in our modest way, I hope we can show that and enjoy each other's company and the dialogue. I've learned so much from Jeff over the years, and I hope to continue to do that, not only from him, but from our guests like Bill Kristol this week. And even though we've been on the opposite side of the political fence for decades, I have great respect for Bill Kristol. It was a real honor, frankly, for me, and I mean that, to be able to talk to him. I really enjoyed it.
I'm sure the both of you have spent some time in the past year around people who do not agree at all with your worldview or your takes. I often find that folks I talk to are just looking for ways to continue to have relationships with people they don't agree with. Do you have any advice or any examples of like how you've been dealing with those conversations on a personal level?
I always try to find common ground if I ever find myself in that situation. And look, when I was chair of the party, and still to this day, there are people inside the Democratic Party that I disagree with. But I try to find common ground so that we can work together and discuss whatever the topic or issue may be. That's been a little bit more work, perhaps, the last few years, but I think it's still worth trying. I mean, we're all in this together as Americans. You know, Trump voters aren't leaving the country. They're not going to leave Michigan, and vice versa. So we've got to figure out a way to live together and work together and try to, you know, rebuild trust in each other.
It's kind of funny to think that discontent might be the tie that binds us all together right now.
Well, we certainly have seen very few instances in our history where we've been so polarized, so divided. And in a way that, you know, less than 2 months ago, let's not forget, there was a lethal attempt to subvert democracy and subvert the conclusion of the election. We've seldom, if ever, been so close to the abyss when it comes to the future of our democratic republic in the system that we've all operated under, the notion that there are winners and losers in an election, that it's not public relations or might that determine the outcome of an election. And the fact that we were able to avert a catastrophe, a collapse of the entire system back in January, doesn't mean that we've escaped the danger. There's still a sect of insanity out there, and there's a toxicity that exists in our politics that isn't going to go away. We're one election away from it all happening again.
In the language of politics, the way that you two both, you know, spent many years as students of and practitioners of it, in the language of politics, you live and die by the extent to which you can frame reality for people who might vote for your candidate, who might give money to your party. Does the radicalization in the public sphere suggest that we need to get people to just think about politics differently, to think of it as less of a war and more of a negotiation?
Yeah, you know, I think so. Look, when I was party chair, and again, still to this day, we fought as hard as we could in elections, won some, lost some. But I always believed, and I said this, after the election, you go to the legislature, you go to Congress, you know, you serve in executive office, and you work together to govern. And that means compromise. That means compromise. Nobody ever gets their way. And then, you know, you bring up those whatever grievances and disagreements you have at the next election. That's what elections are for. You don't have constant chronic fighting all the time. You work together to govern. That's an ideal I'd like to get back to.
My guests today are Mark Brewer, former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, and Jeff Timmer, former chair of the Michigan GOP. Their new podcast and web series is called A Republic, If You Can Keep It. Hats off for finding the most cynical podcast title of the year, by the way, guys.
Really? I don't think cynical. I think hopeful.
Really?
I think Ben Franklin's quote is always timely, particularly now, given what's going on. And I think we've always got to think about, you know, how do we maintain our democracy? You know, we are, I think, one of the leading examples in the world of how a country, a democracy can thrive and succeed over two centuries.
Yeah, I think Mark underscores an important point. Ben Franklin's quote is very optimistic and congratulatory, you know, that they were able to form a republic. But the if you can keep it underscores it takes work. You can't take it for granted. And I think we found that out in a very unexpected way over these last couple of years.
Just getting back to the question about whether politics as usual should be the usual right now. What is the realistic chance of either party extending something like an olive branch right now with, you know, legislative majorities in Washington and to some degree in Lansing on such a hair's breadth right now? I mean, is political change possible when just holding on to what you have has always been the name of the game?
Well, I look at the Republicans who lost during Trump's term, lost their majority in the House of Representatives, and as he was leaving office, lost their majority in the U.S. Senate, where the Senate is tied 50-50 with Vice President Harris casting the tie-breaking vote. I believe that Joe Biden comes from a place where compromise and listening to opponents is part of his political DNA. However, his opponents do not seem at all willing to compromise or listen. They just seem interested in thwarting and defeating. And I don't think it makes any sense from the perspective of the Biden White House or Chuck Schumer or Nancy Pelosi to negotiate with folks who are just trying to blow everything up. It's equivalent to negotiating with political terrorists.
Mark, isn't that to some extent what Democrats did with Donald Trump, though?
Well, there certainly was opposition there. Absolutely, there was. But I think there were times, and I applaud them, when they did have common ground. I think if Trump had ever come up with his infrastructure plan, there would have been a lot of Democratic support for that. So I think there were a number of initiatives there that could have been the basis for working together. We've really got to get out of this negative loop that we're in, that when people are in office, they feel compelled to continue the war from the election, just looking toward the next election to satisfy what's usually a small but vocal group inside their party, you know, and not work on the work of governing. And I continue to hold out hope that that can be restored, not just nationally, but here in Michigan as well.
Let's talk about gerrymandering. You two brought up the lawsuit at the top of the conversation that people may remember best, sort of turning the conversation about representation on its ear. What do you think of the work of the state's independent voter commission so far? Do you think it's the right solve for taking partisanship out of the drawing of district lines?
I think there's great promise with the commission, but it is a big experiment for us here in Michigan. The criteria are new. They've been turned upside down from the world that Jeff and I and many others operated in for the last several decades. The communities of interest criterion now being predominant as opposed to reservation municipal boundaries. So I remain hopeful, but I think there are a lot of challenges that the commission will face. It's doing all of this for the first time, staffing up, making decisions, holding public hearings, trying to figure out what the criteria mean. So again, I remain optimistic and hopeful, but there's a lot of hard work ahead.
I think the laws of physics are very applicable to politics often. And this is a case where for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And I think that as the Citizens Commission, in its intent was to try to lessen the impact of partisanship in the districting process, it will do that to an extent, but it will also create and add different political pressures, different unforeseen problems or wrinkles. I think that's usually the case when reforms are implemented. There's unforeseen problems, there's new challenges, there's different ways to interpret the intent. And I think, you know, politics is not going to be removed from politics. Politics is like water working its way through a rock. People are still going to be trying to influence and tilt the table their way. And I think it's going to be a continual battle that will never be completely won. Though I applaud the effort so far, we'll see how it turns out.
You know, I wanted to ask you about the basic premise from the lens of people who maybe have been very troubled by American politics for a long time, not just in the past 4 years. And yes, some of those folks ended up being drawn to Donald Trump. But for some people, what we might talk about as collegiality in Washington, D.C. or Lansing, they might see as coziness. You know, we hear this from folks on the political left as well as the political right. What's the best case you can make that our institutions aren't broken, that the gridlock that we see in the Senate and the radicalization of members of the House is something that we can get through, and that these institutions are really the best way we have of governing?
you know, there is a tremendous lack of trust by citizens in government. The best way to restore that is for government to deliver, whether it's, you know, solving the pandemic or reviving the economy. It's results that count. And people in my party have been guilty of this. I mean, we were big advocates starting in the 90s for free trade, but we failed in my party to take care of the people who were hurt by free trade. And that has come back to haunt us as a party. You've got to do both in politics. And so I think, again, delivering results for people is the most important thing that we can do to restore faith in these institutions.
And when it comes to the system working with the House or the Senate or the courts or the White House, I think over the last 4 years, and especially over these last few months, we've witnessed a stress test of our democracy. It was a real live, it wasn't a dress rehearsal, it was a real live stress test. And we understand now, I think, some vulnerable points and some things that might need some examination, that might need some scrutiny and might need some strengthening. And so I think that the system did hold, you know, the Constitution and our rule of law, it's designed to continually change to try to, you know, the more perfect union. We're by no means perfect, but we have the means within the system to try to perfect the system. And I think that's what the last years and the last months and for certain have shown.
Jeff Timmer is the former director of Michigan's Republican Party. Mark Brewer is a former state Democratic Party chair. Their new podcast and web series is A Republic If You Can Keep It. Guys, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for talking to us.
Make sure you subscribe.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
Coming up, wedding season is right around the corner. In a normal year, we'll talk with a couple of people planning, changing, moving their wedding plans in a year of continued uncertainty.
So the original plan had about 100 folks. This one will have about 20.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. For a second year in a row, lovers in love are dealing with all manner of complications for wedding plans. Summer weddings seem a little bit more in reach than they did 6 months ago, but there's still so much to think about, even if you didn't postpone the festivities. How can family join you safely? What's the etiquette around asking guests to mask up? Can you get grandma and grandpa vaccinated in time for their fittings? We're going to talk with a couple of folks who are making plans to tie the knot one way or the other. Let's start out with Norris Howard. He's a journalist working in Detroit, joining us from home, as everybody is these days. Norris, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Norris, how did you and your fiance meet?
We met at a hookah bar in Kalamazoo. I was on my way back from Chicago helping a photographer friend of mine. He had a big event and he needed an extra set of hands, so we turned it into a trip. On the way back, a mutual friend that knew both myself and my future fiance was from Kalamazoo. And so I said, hey, that really attractive girl you know on Instagram, is she still in Kalamazoo? And he said, yeah. And so I said, ping her and let's meet up. And we met at the hookah bar and she did not want to talk to me at all. And so long story short, we did eventually exchange information. She came out to Detroit and we hung out. And after that, it's pretty much been us hanging out every day ever since she ended up moving out to this part of the state. And the rest is, as they say, history.
I have to tell you that somewhere I feel like there's a Broadway musical when Broadway reopens that starts out, we met in a hookah bar in Kalamazoo. That's amazing. When did you get engaged?
We got engaged last May. Not necessarily the height of the pandemic panic, but definitely information was still very, very sparse and we kind of didn't know what was going to happen. But we did know, or at least I knew, that if I could make it through a couple months of total lockdown, not leaving the house, not being able to see family, if I could make it through that with her, then we could get through anything. And so I said, let's not waste any more time, and I proposed.
That is the truest truth I think I've heard about pandemic life and romance. How you knew what you were in for. How did you two start talking about when the wedding should be and what it should look like?
My fiance was very much in favor of the elopement. Just go away. Let's fly to Vegas or whatever when we can fly, get married, just do something small, straightforward, and cheap. And I was like, I have two sides of my entire family in the city of Detroit. I will be dragged. I will be ostracized from my family if I do not have some sort of wedding. And so we planned a fairly sizable wedding for September. So we decided, hey, 100 folks, by September, this thing will be cool. There'll probably be some sort of vaccine or herd immunity. And as we know, September was the prelude to the worst of the outbreak.
How far along did you get in the planning? Had you put money down on a place and made
we
some
did.
Plans?
We did. We put money down. We had a wedding planner in place. So we were essentially, from a planning perspective, in the home stretch of things before we got an email from our venue saying that they were going to have to make major changes and our ceremony was going to be very, very different. And we both just felt it was best that we just make plans elsewhere.
Oh, man. So here we are. It's March. Where are you in your planning as of right now?
It's hilarious that you guys reached out to me because literally this week we finalized all of our plans for our wedding. And in all honesty, I'm actually much more excited about this plan than I was about the previous one. So yeah, we are moving the wedding up actually to May instead of waiting until September. And I couldn't be more excited because it is going to be a smaller, more intimate event, but everybody that would be critical to being at the ceremony from the two of our families will be there.
Wow. How many, dare I ask, how many people at the original plan and how many at the smaller one?
So the original plan had about 100 folks. This one will have about 20.
I have to ask, too. I think it's fantastic that your fiancé has a no-muss, no-fuss attitude toward getting married generally, but how do you think your girl is feeling about this?
You know what? A couple weeks ago when we were really going through things, she literally looked at me and said, I'm about to pull my hair out, and I hate this, so you do everything. You take care of everything. I don't want to deal with it. She is also a solopreneur. So, she's very, very, very hardworking. And so anything that I can do in order to take some pressure off of her, if she asks me, I'll do it. We moved forward over the past couple weeks. And to be perfectly honest, I feel like we both feel way better about this new setup. It's a lot smaller, which she was very happy about. And, you know, the most important people to the two of us from a family standpoint will still be able to come. And that sort of satisfies me in a sense. And so I think we both are much happier with this decision.
I haven't met this woman, but I love her already.
She is the love of my life and she's incredible.
Journalist Norris Howard, coming to us from home in Detroit. Norris, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We wanted to check in with another person planning a wedding in Michigan, one we've been hearing a lot about. Olive Scott is a production assistant on Stateside, and we've watched her toil over this pandemic season trying to plan for her big day. Hey, Olive.
Hi, April.
So what's your meet cute story with your fiance?
So he was in this frat called Metal Frat, and they had a goth night party, and I went, and I saw this boy who was tall, and he had red hair, and I was like, he's the cutest boy I've ever seen in my life. So I went up to him, and I was like, hi, I'm Olive, and he didn't hear me. And then I was like, hi, I'm Olive, and he's like, oh, my name's Cooper. And I was like, oh, hey. And he was like, yeah. And then he's like, have you met my friend Tim? And so then I went down the stairs and I met my fiance. And the boy I was originally trying to talk to is my fiance's best friend slash his best man in his wedding. So
now, Olive, your wedding was scheduled for May 2021. When did you set that date?
I set that date in June of 2020 when I got engaged. I'd always wanted a spring wedding, and I was overly optimistic because I think there was like talks that there was going to be a vaccine by that point. And I was like, yeah, it's going to be fine. Everybody's going to handle the pandemic really great.
Oh, and, the things yeah. we know, the things we know now.
Yeah. So I like went to book my reception venue and at the Ann Arbor Parks and like rec website. And they were like, we are not booking until the new year. And so I was like, okay, that sounds great. I'll just call in January. And then I called in January and they said, we're not booking till February. And then I called in February and then they're like, we're not booking till March. And then I called in March and they're like, we're not booking for the foreseeable future. And I didn't want to book my wedding venue the month before my wedding. So May was not in the cards. So wow. we decided to move it.
Well, what do you have a date you settled on now?
Yeah, we're going with September 10, which is coincidentally the day we met. So it'll be 5 years since we met on our wedding day, which I think ends up being a lot cuter than just some random day in May.
What exactly does rebooking a wedding entail? I mean, I've been through the process once and it almost killed me.
Yeah, so it's difficult. But given that everything has kind of been up in the air since the beginning, it's not too much to handle. So I have a friend who's going to take our photos. So it's not like I have to deal with a contract with that. We're getting married at our church. And so they're really flexible about it. I hadn't booked the reception venue. We hadn't nailed down the caterer stuff. And so it's just kind of making a list in my head of who I've talked to and who I need to let know. And so I have to print out, resave the dates. And I think that's pretty much going to be the biggest thing to deal with.
It sounds like you've been able to effectively dodge a lot of the interactional problems that COVID is forcing us to confront in social situations. Like, will you try to ask people to mask up, or will you ask people not to shake hands with grandma, or things of that nature?
Yeah, and that's like the whole point of a wedding is seeing, I mean, getting married is the whole point of a wedding, but like seeing all these people you haven't seen in a while and two families meeting for the first time and a bunch of people just hanging out and hugging and like getting close to one another. Like that's always been a big part of what the wedding was going to be to me. And I didn't want to have my wedding and everybody's either in a mask or they refuse to wear a mask and then somebody's uncomfortable and then people get in a fight or something. And I just wanted it to be like as easy an occasion for everybody as possible.
Olive Scott, thank you so much for telling us about your wedding and good luck.
Thank you. Thank you.
Today, the Cheers team, Lester Graham and Tammy Coxon, are back with a spring drink you're going to love.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. And gosh, it feels like spring outside today. I think it's going to be warm for a few days. We recorded this in early March, and it's a really warm day. It's 53 degrees right now, which is really amazing since it was in the 20s and teens just 2 days ago. And you've got something that kind of reminds you of spring?
It does. Yeah. So this is Unlocking Spring is what I'm calling this. And it features Norden Akavit.
I know those guys.
Right, so you
That's
remember...
not the color of the Norden Akavit I know, though.
Right, so you remember the first drink we did with Norden Akavit was a gimlet, right? So mm-hmm. gimlet is very classic gin. lime juice simple syrup. And Norden makes it with their akavit and kind of puts an akavit spin on it. And it was delicious. We loved it.
Remind us what akavit is. Where's it come from?
Akavit is a Scandinavian spirit originally, and it is basically, instead of having juniper as a predominant flavor like gin does, it has caraway. There's a lot more to it than that, but that's the big picture. So it's got this fun, savory kind of caraway flavor. But Norden Akavit, which is an awesome Michigan company, really renowned, award-winning akavit, theirs features a wide array of different botanicals, including caraway, of course, but also juniper and sumac and you name it, clementine peels, all sorts of things. So they came out with a cask-matured version.
Interesting. They don't do that in Scandinavia, do they?
They do, actually, depending where you are. Definitely aged akavits there are definitely a thing. There's different styles. Linja, which is one of the most famous brands of Norwegian akavit, has to be aged. It, in fact, has to pass the equator twice in its aging process.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
That's where it gets its name, Linja, for the line. But in the U.S., there's all sorts of weird rules. Like, they can't actually call this an aged akavit or give it an age statement for amount of time. So it is called a cask-matured traditional botanical spirit.
Okay, you're mixing up drinks here, but I'd love to get just a little taste of that before the cocktail.
Okay, I will hook you up with a little taste. Note that this is not just cask-matured, but cask-strength. So a little boozy.
Okay, very nice. Let's take a look at this. Skull.
Nicely done.
So the characteristics of Norden's regular akavit are there, but there is that nice little, and I don't want to say whiskey tasting because it's nothing like whiskey, but it's got that tannin taste, just a tiny bit there.
And also kind of a mellowing.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though it's very high proof.
Yeah, it is a little more mellow that way, but it tastes wonderful.
It's really, really good. So this is aged in former rye barrels. So it originally used to age rye and now used to age
akavit. Another reason
to
like it.
Right. And then this is a blend of 12, 16, and 18-month aged barrels. And they blend three or five of them together at a time to come up with this release.
So what'd you do with this?
So I hearken back to that original gimlet that we made, but I wanted to take it and have it reflect some of the character of this aged spirit. So typically when we think about aged spirits, we think about using lemon juice rather than lime juice. And then this also has, I don't know if you picked up on it, Lester, but some kind of like honeyed flavors and some floral notes that I picked up.
Slight floral notes, I did, yeah.
Right, so I wanted to play off of those things. So the drink is called Unlocking Spring. Has 1.5 ounces of the cask akavit, because it is so high proof, I didn't want to use more than that. 3/4 ounce lemon juice, 1/2 ounce of honey syrup.
Wow, that's a lot, I think, isn't it?
Well, it's about a regular amount.
Honey syrup's 1/2 ounces, water.
Honey syrup is 2 parts honey to 1 part water.
Okay.
And then I added just 1/4 ounce of Amaro Montenegro. So this is an Italian bittersweet liqueur that has a lot of floral notes, some citrus notes, and I just thought it was going to play really nicely.
Well, it looks nice in the glass. Shall we taste it?
Yes.
All right, let's do that. I know you're trying to keep the proof down. I think I would have gone ahead and put another 1/2 ounce of the akavit in there. It's very balanced drink, so I'll give you that. But I was expecting, especially after having a little taste of that akavit alone, a little bit of it being forward. But it's very nice, very drinkable, the kind of thing that you would want to really be careful about drinking because it goes down so easily. Okay, I took another sip, and I do pick up the caraway this time. At first, I picked up a lot of lemon and a little bit of honey, but that time, that caraway really rounds out the taste from the akavit. So that's really good. So you called this Unlocking Spring. Where's this inspiration come from?
So a friend of mine sent me a quote from Kurt Vonnegut. And he,
I met that guy, yeah.
That's cool. He said it at a commencement speech that he gave. And he talks about the seasons and that there aren't actually 4 seasons. There are 6 seasons. And so in the fall, right, we have fall, but then November and December, they're not really winter, but they're not fall either, right? Mm-hmm. January and February, now that's winter. We all know that's winter. And now here we are in this March-April period where it's not really quite spring. I can still see snow outside even though it's a warm day. And so he calls that November-December period locking, and this period now, March and April, is unlocking.
So locking into winter, unlocking out of winter. Okay, got that.
Exactly. So unlocking spring.
Well, it is very spring-like, especially with that citrus and the Nornakovit I just love anyway. But I don't have Montenegro at home. What do I do?
So I have to say, when I was in the development process for this, I hit a stage where I just did the honey syrup without the Montenegro, and that was also fantastic. So if listeners can get their hands on the cask matured Nordenakovit, just using 3/4 of an ounce of honey syrup instead of that 1/2 ounce and leaving out the Montenegro is still going to give you a beautiful version of this cocktail.
Well, here's to unlocking spring.
Absolutely.
Cheers.
Cheers.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Take care of yourself this weekend. We'll see you Monday.